Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. My special guest today is Dr. Natalie Lancer. Natalie is a chartered coaching psychologist, supervisor, and she was a former chair of the British Psychological Society's Division of Coaching Psychology. Natalie works with clients ranging from doctoral students to executives. She also trains coaches using her eight tensions coach training. This is based on existential psychology, which we're going to talk about today. Natalie supervises postgrad students from the New School of Psychotherapy and Counseling. And in 2016, she co-authored Techniques for Coaching and Mentoring with David Clutterbuck. And as a side thing, Natalie's also a stand-up comic, and I saw her perform earlier in the year. So Natalie, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas Podcast. How are you today?
I'm fine. Actually, I'm quite amazed, given my performance, you've invited me on your podcast. So that's quite encouraging, actually.
Yeah, we're hoping for a few jokes in the next 40 minutes. So if you can slide any in, you're very welcome.
Okay, well, I'll pretend I am not, but then if you end up laughing, I'll take it as I was going to.
Good. So you're very interested, and you base your work on existential coaching. So let's start at the very beginning for our listeners. What is existential coaching?
It's coaching from a very wide angle lens. I'm helping people think about their life, not in a micro level. We do get to micro level eventually, but how do you want to exist? We've got very, very short time on this planet. And, you know, if you're lucky, you might have 90 years. And, you know, who knows of those years, how many are going to be good years, so to speak. And that time is very, very precious. And therefore, we've got to make decisions about what we're going to do. It's all about choice. It's also about the freedom to do what you want to do. You know, we sometimes feel bound to pursue a particular career or job, maybe because there's voices in our head from parents or other people with expectations. And often we don't feel free to do the other stuff. But at the same time, where we're free, we have to be responsible. You know, there's no point giving up your job that, you know, is paying for your mortgage and your kids when you haven't got anything to go to. So, like, doing these things responsibly. There's this also all this stuff about relationality, that we're on this on this planet with other people. You know, Sartre said hell is other people, but also all our positive stuff comes from other people. We get very depressed when we're not, you know, with other people. Hence, you know, during COVID, people were not socializing as they did, and people got very lonely. So we do need other people, but how do we want to interact with those people? Can we make some considered decisions about who to spend time with and maybe who not to spend time with? So it's these sorts of things that I'm interested in.
Yeah, so it's coaching as a helping your clients think about how they want to live their life, what choices they want to make, how they want to escape being trapped in certain ways of being and finding new ways.
Yes, and although that sounds a bit airy-fairy, it's actually a very, very practical philosophy. Because it's also this stuff about don't put off, you know, stuff that you want to do, because we don't know when, you know, all sorts of weird things happen in life, right? You know, you know, illness is one thing. Redundancy is another thing. So all the things you want to do in whatever role you have now, you know, I guess the motto is carpe diem. And the other sort of motto here is, you know, not only seize the day, which was the translation of carpe diem, but also don't think that anyone else is going to hand anything to you. You've got to do it on your own. So don't sit around waiting. Get on with it. That's what I say to everyone. Get on with it.
Get on with it. Good. What attracted you to existentialism, Natalie? What was your early kind of
well, actually, I've been espousing this philosophy without knowing what it was called forever. Really, forever. Like, you know, just sort of sums me up, all of that stuff. And people used to think of me as like quite a wise person, maybe a bit wise before my years. And then when I was doing my PhD at Birkbeck in psychology, I still hadn't heard of all this stuff. And then I'm quite a fan of doing random things, hence the stand-up comedy, because that was also a slightly random impulsive act. And I found out that there was a conference that was called a meaning conference, and it was being held in London. So, you know, my philosophy is, you know, is get on with it, go for it. So I found out where it was, booked myself a ticket, and I went to this conference. And for the first time ever, everybody was speaking my language. It was like I was home. And I've gone to loads of conferences in my academic life, and most of them I feel like a lemon. But at this one, I was like, oh my goodness, everyone's talking about the same stuff that I talk about all the time. And then I went and found sort of the head person of this, which is Emmy van Derzen, because she's like the existential leader par excellence, and all the stuff she writes is amazing. And I just was a bit of a fangirl to her, and I just sort of said, hi, I want to come and work for you. I don't even know what you do, but you need to be in my life, and I think you're going to want me in yours. Obviously, she found that slightly weird. But anyway, that's how I got working for the New School of Psychotherapy and Counselling, where I supervise masters and doctoral students who are taking an existential approach. And that is what I did in my own PhD. And I love it. I love doing that because we're all speaking the same language again.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I came across Sartre's work poor Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist. Probably in my early 20s, I had a friend who was studying at university. I got thrown out of school, but I kind of learned secondhand from him. He kind of used to tell me what he was learning and pass it on, and I was very curious and interested. And it's very, very powerful, and it's kind of stayed in our work as a coach. And Emmy van Derzen, when I trained as a therapist, she was an important kind of part of that work, alongside Irvin Yalom, who was a huge influence on me as a therapist.
I love Irvin Yalom. If this very quick thing is, I was reading The Gift of Therapy. Basically, I suggest to listeners to read anything he wrote. And he writes in a very down-to-earth style. And one of the things I hate is academic mumbo-jumbo. So when people start talking mumbo-jumbo at me, and worse is when they write in mumbo-jumbo, you know, it's a real turn-off. And he writes so simply, as does Emmy. And, you know, one should not confuse the idea that writing simply means what you're reading is simple. That's not the same thing. And he wrote something so funny, which is that he was thinking about a client who he had for many years, and he had a particularly good therapy session with her. And he asked, you know, what was the highlight of the session, you know, thinking about all this existential stuff and the meaning of life stuff and all. And she said, when I walked in today, you said my hair looked nice. And I just thought, yeah, just bring it back to groundedness and human nature. That is what people like to hear. People like to hear their hair looks nice. But I like how he took it, and he said, we can pontificate all we want and think that the coaching session was all about all this highfalutin stuff. And actually, it was actually just recognizing that she'd like gone to the hairdresser, done something, and just seeing her and her feeling like, yeah, I've been noticed.
Yeah. So existentialism, sometimes people think of it as a bit bleak. Some of the novels are a bit bleak, and it focuses on death quite a lot. But tell us something about kind of the relationship between maybe death and life, or kind of what sense you make of that.
I mean, I don't think it's bleak at all. You know, the problem is that death is very, it's a taboo. You know, we don't like talking about death. We hate talking about wills and plans for death. I mean, who wants to spend time talking about that, right? But the point is that when you are clear that we are here for a finite time, it makes it all the more pressing to live every day as if it's your last, in a good way. Like, you know, really just squeeze out every last drop and enjoy it. And, you know, make a difference to someone else. And, you know, whatever it means to you to live meaningfully, you know, don't put off living meaningfully. Do it now. The saddest thing I hear is there's so many studies of this, that when people retire, you know, they put off all the things they want to do for their retirement, and then they drop down dead. And they drop down dead because, you know, people need that structure in their life. That's another thing I talk about a lot. And existential stuff is relevant. It's about, you know, this idea of structure, that it's incumbent on us to structure our lives. You know, when you go to school and it's, you know, get there for whatever time you get there, 8:40 till 4 or whatever, and then you go to a job and it may well be 9 to 5. That structure of time is imposed upon you. But actually, particularly when you work for yourself, which I do, and I work with a lot of entrepreneurs and also other coaches who work for themselves, you have to structure your own time. And that is weird, because not many people end up having to do that. And I think when people retire, it's so like overwhelming having to do all this stuff and think it through from first principles, that I think it just literally is too much for some people.
Yeah.
People like working, but I think working's very good for you. I think it's so, well, this one quick thing. When I had my first child and I was on maternity leave, I was actually a teacher at that time. And so I had a year off for maternity, and it was sort of like day one. And I was like, okay, what do you do? You know, because I was a teacher, because teaching is the most structured thing you could ever do, right? I remember ringing up my sister and she said, you've got to create your own life. Like, go to groups, go and meet other mums, go and like do stuff with your baby. And I was like, oh, okay. And I know that's like super obvious when I say it out loud, but I then sort of extended that template to the whole of life and people's lives. And, you know, we can create what we want if you're open to creating it. It's hard work doing it yourself and not having it served on a plate, but you can do it.
Yeah. No, when I was younger, I fell in with the anarchists, and they used to ask a question, what are you doing and why are you doing it? And it's just stayed with me kind of my whole life. It's like, I keep asking myself that, you know, am I doing something purposeful? Am I doing something meaningful for myself? You know, what am I doing and why am I doing it? Does existentialism in your mind, how does it relate to spirituality, to God? I mean, the idea that there's a finite life is a very human kind of a...
Yes. Well, the answer is that existentialism as a whole sounds like it's a thing, and it is a thing. But existentialists, like any of the ones you've heard of, you've mentioned Sartre, we can mention Buber, we can talk about Heidegger, Marcel, some of them were religious and some of them didn't believe in God at all. And they had different ideas about this. Incidentally, some of them were Jewish, some of them were Christian, like Paul Tillich, as an example, was a Christian existentialist. Martin Buber was a Jewish existentialist. And then you had a load of, you know, atheists. So the answer is there isn't one answer. The answer is there's no answer. I think that I imagine one could, and it'd be interesting to hear your views on this, Simon, as well, but I can imagine that this idea of life is finite, therefore do good while you're here, you know, make an impact while you're here. What's your legacy? What's that all about? I imagine, you know, one can interpret that in a religious sense about doing good. For me, I am Jewish. I think it, you know, to be honest with you, that I haven't related my existential beliefs to religion, partly because I'm not that religious, but also actually is, having said that, it is quite Jewish to say, you know, to life, l'chaim, to life, you know, live your life, stop worrying about death and what happens afterwards, like just get on with this life.
I mean, there's a strong link with Jewish thinkers and existentialism. That's kind of, there are quite a few people you've already named, and that experience. I mean, I think religion and like Nietzsche's kind of ideas, God is dead, kind of make your own life and become a super Uberman, took it in one direction.
Well, actually, I love Nietzsche, and obviously, it wasn't him who turned his ideas into the Nazi, you know, slogans. He didn't mean at all how it was skewed. So he's someone who's been misappropriated to the max. But God is dead means, it's this thing about the blueprint that I was saying earlier. It's the same about what I was saying about being institutionalized by school and work. It's the same point, which is if there are no outside blueprints on how to live your life, i.e. religion, how would you live it? And it's a mind-boggling question, you know, and most people don't think about it because it's actually easier not to. And that's the thing, is that the existentialist message is actually, it's quite a lot of work to think about these things. And it's responsibility as well, because you're not sort of saying, well, you're saying the buck stops with me. You know, if I've screwed up something, then it's my responsibility. But the reason why I find it all very uplifting is that it's very clear that we can reinvent ourselves all the time. So we aren't something that is fixed like a stone. We are something that can evolve in different directions. Take me and my stand-up comedy, right? You know, I woke up one day and thought, that sounds like an interesting thing to do. I'll just find out if there's like a course I can do locally. Would you know, there was a course starting in a week's time very near me. And I thought, oh, I'll just do that. And I just sort of see where it took me. But, you know, the fact is, I've never done anything like that before. And that's a very sort of, you know, trivial example, actually. But think about people who are having multiple careers. Think about people who had like different mindsets and turned over a new leaf, you know, in different contexts. The message is that we can start again, you know, and we can start again many times. And I think that is the most uplifting thing, you know, just because you were doing X, Y, and Z before, you aren't limited. We can transcend our former position. And more than that, you can transcend where you were born, to what family you were born. That isn't to say that we all have, you know, free rein. Obviously, you know, if you're born to, you know, a very poor family in a poor part of the world, then you aren't going to have the same chances as somebody in the West. It's not a naive statement, but it's saying within your context, there are choices you can still make. Viktor Frankl, you know, very famously was the proponent of this. As you know, he was interned in Auschwitz. And he said, you know, we can decide if there's a bit, this is bleak, actually. Sorry, we've gone down a bleak side here. But the point is that if nothing else, you can decide in like what mindset you meet your death. That's like one choice. But there are other choices that you can make throughout your life. And he was, if you've never, I mean, I know you have, but if your listeners haven't read Man's Search for Meaning, my God, that's a good book. And it's short and it's simply written. Hence my, I wish everyone would write short and simple books. And the message is very clear. He said, some people gave up in the camp, as you can imagine. I would totally have given up immediately, by the way. You know, they sort of ran into the electric fence and just killed themselves straight away because they couldn't face, you know, what would have happened. Yeah, and he decided to just take each day as it came and see what happened. And he was meant to be gassed, and he missed the bus. They thought the bus was going somewhere. God knows where they thought it was going. And anyway, it wasn't going where they thought it was going, but he missed it and he was gutted. He'd missed the bus. I think he thought he was giving a talk to someone or something. I can't remember. Anyway, it was lucky he missed the bus because it was definitely not going in the right direction. And that saved him. And I think there's this idea as well that, you know, I talk a lot about the fluidity of life. And, you know, we all hear when there was that awful plane crash in India recently, you know, there's a number of people who said they missed the plane. You know, they were in traffic. They missed the plane. And, you know, there's all sorts of weird things that happen. And that's why I'm never too worried about being late. I'm never too worried about things not happening in the way that I thought, because like, you know, maybe there's a reason you're late. Maybe there's a reason, you know. Mm. So I just sort of go with the flow with it, but at the same time try and impose a bit of structure, which sounds like that is a paradox, and it is actually. That's the other thing.
I think it is managing the paradox. It's the same as like one of the challenges to existentialism is it's it can be seen as a very individualistic way of thinking. So you could actually like start thinking about it is hyper-individualistic, about free choice for me, could even slip into narcissism. But there's also a collective responsibility. There's something about society as well, and about how you play your part in society, isn't there?
Yeah, I think, you know, Nietzsche said, which Frankl took up, he who has a why to live can bear almost any how. And it's this thing about the why to live, and a tiny little anecdote about, well, you don't know this, or I don't think a lot of people don't know this actually about me, which is I started life actually as a medical student, and I didn't like it. And after 3 months, I left. And I always remember that the dean of the medical school said, there's no other profession where you can save people like medicine. And I said, I know that's not true. I said, because you can save someone, but to live for what reason? There's no point saving someone if they don't have a reason to live. This is what I mean. I was saying all this stuff before I'd even read Nietzsche. So I didn't know all the stuff was obviously wasn't very pleased with that answer. But we need a reason to live. And again, as Viktor Frankl said, very practically, the best thing you can do if you're searching for your why is to help other people. It's through helping other people, it's through doing volunteering and helping others, you will find your happiness. All this stuff about write 3 things you enjoyed in the evening to be happy. Sorry, that smacks of mumbo jumbo to me. That's really, like, I feel like I've been really offensive there. Sorry. But it is a mumbo jumbo, because you don't need to write 3 things that made you happy. You just need to go and help someone, and that will make you happy. You don't need to, like, manufacture it.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, both, I think the happiness industry has kind of gone mad, and I think like you say, it's happiness comes as a byproduct of social action, of engaging with other people, of engagement rather than aiming directly for it, because you're never going to find it that way.
The other thing I love about the existentialist stuff is that it's timeless. You know, these truths that we're saying, I mean, they're like obviously, you know, big concepts, but they're concepts from the last, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years. Some of this is in the Hebrew Bible. Some of this is like Greek, ideas from the greats there. Some of this is Thomas Aquinas, and we've called all these ideas existential, but the truth is they've been around for a long time. And that's the other thing I like about them. It's not newfangled nonsense. This is like real stuff.
Yeah. One of our strap lines in my coaching training is about living in good faith, about good faith and bad faith. Do you want to say something about Sartre's ideas of good faith and bad faith?
Yeah. So first of all, Sartre's examples are like not for our age. So they're like really offensive to our modern ears. I don't care about that, because I understand that things were written in different times. A lot of people haven't quite cottoned on to that idea, but never mind. So I might try and not to use his personal examples, but basically when we do something, I am going to have to use his example. Well, when we do something not authentically, I think that's probably a good thing to say. So let me give you one of his examples. He says, it's kind of cute, to be honest, that when a woman lets a man hold her hand and she's sort of looking away and sort of pretending it's not going on, and she's like pretending that she's not part of this hand, and what the implication of her hand being held means, which, again, this is all rather quaint. Yeah, let me translate this for you. This is swiping right on Tinder, okay? Yeah. Anyway, so when the lady sort of professes to be ignorant of it, this is being in bad faith. So it's like being inauthentic. Whereas what the existentialists implore us to do is to not hide away, not pretend things aren't happening, but I'm going to quote someone I love called Bo Jacobson. Look things squarely in the eye and tackle them head on. So if you don't want your hand held in whatever situation you're going to be in later, potentially, then you say, excuse me, I'm not interested in you, but let's have a nice chat anyway, rather than just pretend it's not happening, that sort of thing. And it's basically calling things out, standing up for what you believe in, and just to saying things how they are. This is another thing. I've always said things how they are, too much, actually. And it turns out that's living in good faith. So I'm all right.
Yeah. And there's also something about living in internally for yourself in good and bad faith, isn't it? About being honest with yourself around kind of like we can use defense mechanisms. We can disassociate from self. We can use many, many kind of ways to kind of hide from our own truths. And it encourages us to kind of face ourselves as well as our relationships, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I think, you know, you can, you know, obviously you hear these days people use the word self-medicating, you know, when they've got issues that are difficult, and, you know, people might resort to taking drugs or, you know, all sorts of different things. And actually, you don't often hear people sort of talk about that in terms of bad faith. But if you're consciously doing it, then I think it is in bad faith, because it's essentially escaping from something. And it's, as I said, existentialism is hard. It's really hard to face up to dark things in your life and things that are uncomfortable. It's the hardest thing you can do. But when you're in a situation where you have the strength to do that, then, you know, we can start living in that way, and we can feel lighter for it. And everything else we do, like whether it's, you know, drugs, drink, you know, whatever it is you're doing to cover it up, that is, it's a plaster, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's what Sartre would call bad faith.
Yeah. Is it right that I'm trying to remember Sartre's thinking? He was against psychoanalysis and the unconscious because he thought that was acting in bad faith, that you hide behind your unconscious. Am I right in saying that, or have I got that wrong, Natalie?
I don't really know, to be honest with you. So I'm going to fess up there and live
okay.
The value I just said, which is don't know. Sorry.
Yeah. Because I remember thinking that, like, that's quite a dilemma for me. Well, it's not a dilemma, but it's like living in the paradox of being an individual and part of society, living in it with our conscious and our unconscious experiences, and where does bad faith come into that? I think it's kind of very interesting that, you know.
Yeah, well, what I can talk about a little bit is phenomenology. So this is an allied thing to existential psychology, and at its simplest, I mean, it's actually a research method as well, but at its simplest, it's saying that we're interested in people's experiences. So literally what they're doing in a grounded way rather than what's going on in their psyche. So in that way, you know, I mean, again, a very sort of broad brush way of thinking about this is that it's about what you do, not what you think.
Yeah.
I've got a saying somewhere, which I'll have to look up, a Confucius saying, I thought it was on my whiteboard, but it's not, about, you know, I'm going to botch this one up actually, but something like, it's not good enough to know something, you've got to do it. It doesn't count if you just know it, you've got to do it. And I think it's, you know, actions are really important.
Yeah.
I'm looking up what is that? I probably won't find it, so never mind.
Do clients come to you, do you attract clients because they are searching for meaning in their lives, or do you deal with, do people come to you for coaching just openly, and you take an existential approach when you're working with them? How does that kind of show up in your clinic, in your practice?
Well, it's a very good question. So I think there's a continuum here of what happens. So I'm known for my eight tensions model, which is essentially a set of eight paradoxes, which I call tensions. And my idea, and I mean, it's not really my idea, again, this is like got like a 4,000 year legacy, but I've turned it into a 21st century usable thing. We are all straddling paradoxes, like we were saying, between fluidity of life and structure, that, you know, one doesn't want to be just one and not the other, but, you know, there are times when it'd be more useful to be fluid, and there are times when it's useful to be structured, and sort of thinking about these in relation to people's context. So sometimes people want to go through those eight tensions with me methodically, like let's go for maybe a session attention. Sometimes, you know, they want to pick out a few that are specifically relevant. Sometimes people don't know I've written all this stuff about the eight tensions, and they just think, oh, you know, she looks all right. And we do a bit of coaching. And then I might sort of say, sounds like you're in a dilemma between, you know, being you and fitting in, which is actually one of the tensions, a bit like you were just saying just now about sort of how we operate in the world. And depending on sort of the reaction I get to putting it in that form, I might say, by the way, there's this list of eight tensions. Would you like to look at them? And sometimes they're like, yeah, no, not really. But sometimes, so I will sort of read the room a bit and see. But I have noticed that a lot of people love these existential ideas, and they derive great comfort from knowing that they're not the only people grappling with these really big questions of how to live life. I mean, I thought for years, I think for the first like 30 years of my life, I'm not that old, by the way, but anyway, for the first 30 years of my life, I thought that, you know, I don't know, why do I struggle and worry about these things that frankly nobody else seems to care about? You know, I'm sort of, it was like, actually, my dad cares about this stuff. So I probably inherited a bit of that and a bit of sort of environmental, like really big questions of, you know, life, the cosmos, and what are we doing here? And everyone else is like, yeah, should we just get a drink or something? And I'm like, I don't know. So, but the truth is that people, it doesn't take much for people to talk about these ideas. And when they realize that you've created a safe space to talk about these huge things, like what's the point of your life, which is a pretty big question, actually, there's no stopping them. And people want to talk about this all the time.
Yeah. And from a young age, I mean, I had a really interesting chat with my 12-year-old daughter a couple of weeks ago. She was having a bad day in school, and she came back and she was a bit fed up, and she started telling me life's pointless and she feels pointless. There's no point to it, Dad.
Yes.
And I said, yeah, precisely. That's what Jean-Paul Sartre said. She said, who's that? I said, he's this philosopher. And he says that it is pointless, but you have to make a point out of it. It's up to you to make which point you want out of it. You have to make meaning out of your own life. And about 3 hours later, she came back. She said, that was really, really helpful. Got that, like, you know, and it's kind of stuck with her. It's really interesting, you know, 12-year-old, but it kind of sticks with you, the idea, you know, you can feel emptiness and pointlessness, you know, but then you kind of turn that on its head and say, well, so what are you going to do with that? You know, what life are you going to make for yourself? And, it, you know, from a young age, people pick up on it. It's interesting.
Yeah. And again, back to this idea of a simple idea not being simplistic or some nugget like that. Yeah. But of course, the 12-year-old should understand it. Like, anything worth understanding, you know, should be understood by young people. I mean, it's not complicated, this stuff, right?
No.
And the earlier we teach people these things, the better, I think. I mean, how liberating to know that life is completely pointless. It is. It is completely pointless. Great. So I'm just repeating what you said, Simon. Great. So what are you going to do with it then? Oh, well, anything. Because anything's better than nothing, right? Anything is something over nothing. And this is why I find it odd, because a lot of people say, isn't that depressing that life's pointless? I said, absolutely not. It's liberating. It's giving you the chance to make what you want of it. And that's it, really. Actually, no, I remember my supervisor in my PhD, she was giving a talk about meaning, and I'd done a lot of research about meaning, as in research meaning, well, there you go, now I'm going to keep using the words meaning. And she said, well, could you just give me an overview of meaning, because I need to like say it in a talk I'm giving. And I said, yeah, there is no meaning, you just make your own. And she was like, is that it? I was like, yep. But I would add to that that I do think that micro meanings, and I think that might be a Natalie term, micro meanings become really important. So by which I mean quite a lot of different things by that, actually. I mean beauty, like seeing a beautiful sunset, seeing, you know, I've just come back from a few days by the sea, and I love seeing the sea. It's like a really weird thing. I just love seeing a beach. I don't mean it was terrible weather. I wasn't sitting on the beach, but I something about seeing the sea,
yeah,
that really moves me. You know, having a tender moment with a loved one, when, you know, one of things I don't understand about teenagers, you know, I wake up in the morning and I have this barrage of texts from my daughter saying, you're a freak, you're a weirdo. I'm like, okay. And then she comes up to me and said, Mum, I love you. I'm like, is that the same person who said those words? But, you know, actually, when someone who normally uses other vocabulary with you suddenly says, Mum, I love you, my God, you know, that's what it's all about. These are the micro meanings. So as much as I poo-pooed this, what are the three things that make you happy at the end of the day, which, you know, I don't love that, But what I would like to recast that as is in the moment, you don't need to think about this at the end of the day, but whilst these things are happening real time, you can savor those and you can say, yeah, this is good. This is what it's about.
Very good. So we're coming to the end of a podcast. We always ask at the end of this podcast what it means to live a good life and what it means to create a good society. And we ask our guests to think about their life's experience, not some philosophy, but kind of something from your life experience or your work, which can you'd like to share as a final word to our audience.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, I was talking to a friend the other day and they said to me, you always do such interesting things in your life. Your life is a life well lived. And I was really struck by that, partly because I thought, I was worried he thought I was about to drop down dead or something like that. So I was a bit mortified. But the other thing is, I thought that's nice that someone else thought that, because I think that as well. Like, I feel very fulfilled and, you know, worst thing in the world, you know, if my life was ended, you know, shortly, I would never say to myself, I really regret that I didn't do this or I didn't do this. So, and as I said, that's sort of like a motto and how I live. So my sort of idea of the good life is to not have any regrets. You know, it might be a bit twee to say life's not a rehearsal, but life's not a rehearsal.
Very good. Natalie Lancer, thank you very much for being our guest. That was very enlightening and enjoyable. Keep on the good work. Keep up the comedy and we'll see you along the journey. Thanks.
Thanks, Simon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just for the audience, just to let you know, we have a diploma in coaching starting in September online, and we deal with some of these issues of good faith and bad faith. So if you're interested, please get in touch. Bye for now.